It's more than $800 billion, but if you really want to put those stimulus dollars in context...
I mean, if this bill were a country, it would be the 15th largest country in the world.
The United States of Stimulus. Are you pledging allegiance? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 9th. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined in the studio by Catherine Lamfer. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away today. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Todd. In this hour, we look both at the status of the stimulus bill and what it says about hopes for a more bipartisan Congress. We check in on efforts to save the old buildings of the New Deal, and we give you a hand with all those big numbers whizzing by these days. But first, these headlines.
President Barack Obama is road tripping this week in a move to garner more support for his economic stimulus plan. He'll hold a town hall meeting in Elkhart, Indiana today and another in Fort Myers, Florida tomorrow. GOP Congressman Mike Pence said yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press that the president needs the support.
The American people know we can't borrow and spend and bail our way back to a growing economy. The only thing this bill is going to stimulate is more government and more debt.
Now, the president has enough lawmakers on his side to pass the bill in the Senate. Three Republicans are expected to join Democrats in voting for it tomorrow. After it passes the Senate, lawmakers will have to merge it with the vastly different version that was passed by the House earlier this week. Australia is launching a high-level investigation into 400 fires that tore through the country over the weekend. Police believe the fires were deliberately set. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says this is a terrible time for the entire country.
There'll be many difficulties on the way, and this won't be smooth sailing. And as I said before, the nation needs to brace itself for what I believe will be a very challenging time ahead.
At least 130 people have died so far. That number is expected to rise.
Robert Plant and Alison Krauss were big winners at the Grammys last night. They won five in all, including Album of the Year for Raising San. Lil Wayne was right behind them with four Grammys, and Coldplay took home three, including Song of the Year for Viva La Vida. The EPA says a massive oil spill near Chicago is mostly contained. 65,000 gallons of sludge were released yesterday when a holding tank at a Caterpillar facility broke. Most of the sludge spilled onto land, but some seeped into the nearby Des Plaines River.
Japanese car maker Nissan announced today that it will cut 20,000 jobs worldwide. It's yet to say which plants will be affected, though. The layoffs come as the company forecasts a net loss of nearly $3 billion for this year. The Dow opens at 8281 today. The S&P opens at 869. Both indicators jump nearly 3% on Friday.
All right. Now, they're debating the stimulus plan in Washington, and of course, we're debating it all over the United States. We'd like to know what's in your debate. What do you need for your own personal stimulus, Todd? Anything?
I decided I need an intern. Now, it's not a paying position, but this person will get long-term employment opportunities.
You're selfless, thinking about the country
right.
First. That's you, Todd. How do you think the stimulus money should be spent? What would you like to see in your town, in your family? Go ahead, let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Intern. Nice way to troll.
I'm busy.
Uh-huh.
I need the help. Trust
Whatever.
Me. Whatever. Good letter of recommendation. I promise you that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Both John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away today.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Senator Ben Nelson from Nebraska has a posse. You may remember Senator Nelson from the Gang of 14. That was on judicial nominations. And the Gang of 10. That was on gas prices and energy. Both were groups of centrists, Republicans and Democrats, gathered to compromise on those specific issues. Well, now he's got another gang to address President Obama's economic stimulus package. It's just a gang of three, but it's a gang nonetheless. The president stressed that he wants a bipartisan solution to the economic crisis, and Senator Nelson is at the center of it.
Our bipartisan group worked long and hard, going line by line, dollar by dollar, to reduce spending from the original bill. We trimmed the fat, fried the bacon, and milked the sacred cows.
And use the metaphors. He joins us now, Senator Nelson from Nebraska. Your group trimmed about $100 billion from the bill, but what were the hardest cuts in those late-night sessions with Senator Collins?
Well, it's very difficult to reduce the amount of money that was there for a variety of different important programs, including education for other similar programs. But when you take a look at what was left in the bill, for education, there were $60 billion left in the bill. That's 1.5 times of the annual U.S. Department of Education budget, which is roughly $40 billion. That's on top of that as well. So I think we were generous. We just weren't at the same level that it came out of the House and it was coming out of the Senate. Yet, I think that when you take a look at the reductions and the bottom line left, that is most generous for education, which is critically important to us.
Okay, Senator. Well, in we mentioned in the intro that you've got a long history of these bipartisan gangs to try to reach across the aisle. How come this time the gang is only three? You know, on energy and on judicial nominations, there were so many more senators. Why could you only draw three into the coalition this time, do you think?
Because the attacks from the other side on a partisan basis are so significant and so vitriolic in some cases that it's very difficult to get people to step forward. That's why it's notable that Senator Collins and I were able to work together, and it's notable to bring on board both Olympia Snowe and Arlen Specter. There probably, and I hope this will be the case, will be other Republicans who will join us when the vote is taken sometime tomorrow. At least I hope there will be. When you have the president seeking bipartisan support, it's at a time with a bill that is the largest that's been dealt with. It's the most complex bill that has been presented to us in terms of trying to stimulate the economy. Now, there are some that have just a different view, but I think it's fairly cavalier to sit on the sideline and say you have a choice to do nothing. We don't have a choice to do nothing. We have to do something. We have choices. We have choices as to whether to do it the way we've done it, the way the House wanted to do it, or the way the Senate wanted to do it. I rejected what the House proposed, and I rejected what the original Senate version was, and that's why we put together this bipartisan approach.
Well, Senator Max Baucus, who's, of course, chairman of the Finance Committee, I noticed he sat on the floor in the middle of last week, seemed to be sort of a minute of maybe a little bit of frustration on his part, said, look, none of us really knows if this is going to work. None of us really knows if we have the right mix of tax cuts and spending, short-term and long-term stimulation. We're doing the best we can. We don't really know if it's going to work. Will you join us and help us? Do you share his uncertainty that nobody really knows if this is going to do any good?
Well, nobody knows for sure. We've never experienced this before. And so what we're doing is we're taking the best advice that we can from economists who, whether the Republican or Democrat, seem to share the same view that you need to pass something in the range of $800 billion, and it needs to be a mix of certain amounts of spending for infrastructure and job creation and for tax cuts. Look, this recession or depression possibility doesn't come with a set of instructions, but I'm confident, just like when Christmas Eve, some assembly is required.
All right. All right. Well, you're heading into the conference committee with the House, assuming this passes the cloture vote this evening and final passage tomorrow, into difficult negotiations with the House. The number differences aren't big, but the philosophical differences are quite big. Where do you see the main pivot points? Where are the moving parts, to use another metaphor, in negotiations with the House?
Well, I'm not sure there are going to be many negotiations with the House. Senator Collins has made it clear if it doesn't come back as it is, she's not going to vote for it. And so you can't act like you've got all the votes when you don't. Sometimes you have to put together a package that recognizes the votes. Vote counting here in Washington is critical. So what I would suggest is that the version that we put together will be essentially the version that passes, if anything is going to pass, and it has to come back from the conference in that format.
Well, the House is going to love My Way or the Highway, aren't they?
Well, you know, it doesn't. Look, I'm not suggesting it has to be My Way or the Highway, but if they want my vote, that's what it's going to have to be. I don't think you can justify a lot of the programs that were put out there as part of a stimulus package. I'm not really critical of sacred cows. I just think in this particular situation, sacred cows can't be part of the mix. They can be part of the budget process. They can be part of an omnibus process. It's just when you call something stimulus, the American people have a right to look at it and decide if it's stimulus or not. And I've seen and talked to so many who thought that the House version was limited stimulus, and the Senate version might have been a bit better, but was still limited stimulus. You know, smoking cessation programs are worthwhile. And a lot of the research that was put out there, including that for STD, those are worthwhile programs. But it's hard to establish that they're robust in terms of job creation, job protection, that they're not really related to jobs.
We keep talking about what's in the packages, but the timing here is so important. How likely, I mean, with all of this debate that's going on back and forth, what about those people who are saying, look, we need something now?
Well, I agree. It has to be timely. And that's why we put this together the way we have. And I think that's why President Obama said, I want it by the president's break, which is by this Friday. So I know everybody is going to do what they can to try to meet that deadline. And that's also why a group of us, Republicans and Democrats, a few more Republicans, about six at any one time this last week, and 12 Democrats met all last week at various times to put together this package. Now, some of the Republicans, at the end of it, didn't quite meet their expectations, but they participated and had input at every step along the way.
So you said, Senator, that you have the votes and there's not a lot of leeway because you basically got 60 at this point, maybe 61, but it's essentially 60.
That's correct. Yeah.
So there's not a lot of room for give and take with the House at this point. Do you have any expectation? You said you hope that more Republicans will vote for it, but do you have any expectation that when this comes out of conference committee that there will be more than three Republicans in the entire Congress that will support it? And my second question is, mm-hmm. does it really matter, or is the point just to get it done?
Well, the point is to get it done, but it does matter. The president has been on Capitol Hill talking to the Republicans and Democrats on the House side and on the Senate side, and he's made it clear about job losses. 3.5 million last year, and half of those in about the last 3 months. That's why he has said this is essential. We can't let the desire for the perfect get in the way of the essential. And timing is important. It needs to be temporary. It needs to be targeted. There's no question about it. And that's where we are at the moment. And if we can continue to work on it this week, I believe the House will understand. And there are good vote counters over there. And this isn't everything that everybody on this side likes either.
Right.
But I think it is an effort at a compromise to get the votes. It would be wonderful if this had 70 votes at the end of the day.
Well, Senator Schumer already said that 70 or 80 votes is a distant memory. But you've got 60, and I guess that's enough. Senator Ben Nelson from Nebraska, leader of the latest Gang of Three, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Well, that was Senator Ben Nelson negotiating the bipartisan agreement, enough to get the stimulus passed.
We want to know what's going to pass in your house, in your town, in your state. Give us a call. Tell us what you'd like to see in the stimulus package, what's really going to work for you. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a note, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away today. Catherine Lamford is joining me here in the studio. Well, as we all know, Congress is debating the big economic stimulus plan. We just talked to Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, and you have something to say, too.
I'm calling in response to Senator Nelson's comments, as well as to the bill. He's calling it the attacks on it vitriolic and partisan. Well, debt is the reason we got ourselves into this problem in this country. Debt is not the reason or the solution to getting ourselves out of it.
What's your take? Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Todd, this week and every week lately, it's all about the numbers.
$40 billion here, $40 billion there.
3.6 million jobs.
$650 million.
11.2%.
$495.
More than 11.5 million people are now out of work.
These numbers demand action.
Whew, these numbers make me dizzy. What does it really mean that we have the worst unemployment rate in 16 years, or that December saw the worst job loss since 1974? We need numbers, obviously, to paint an accurate picture of life around us, but they can be tricky. And to help us, we're going to turn now to economist Andrew Dilnot. He's the former host of a BBC show called More or Less. It was all about numbers. And he's the co-author of The Numbers Game, the common sense guide to understanding numbers in the news, in politics, and in life. Hey, Andrew, good to have you on.
It's great to be with you.
Well, let's start with the unemployment stats that came out on Friday. 598,000 jobs were cut, the most in 34 years. But numbers like that don't necessarily take into account other numbers like population growth, right?
Absolutely. So we love headlines that say there's a record, and I'm a journalist too, and it's terribly tempting to go for the record, but saying that it's the largest number of jobs that have been lost in 34 years, well, that's true, but I checked this morning to see what's happened to the US population in the last 34 years, and it's risen by just more than 40%. So it's not an intelligible way of comparing what's going on. The right way to compare it is the unemployment rate, which is now up at 7.6%, and that's high. But it's not remarkably high. It was higher than that in 1993 at 7.8%, in 1982 at 10.8%, in 1975 at 9%. So in the period since we saw as many job losses, 598,000, as we saw last time, in fact, the unemployment rate's been higher than that three times. It's the unemployment rate we should look at, which takes into account the size of the population, not the numbers, however dramatic the numbers sound.
I was just going to say, Andrew, I know that you want us to know that numbers are beautiful, but once you go past, I'd say, one or two statistics, my mind blanks out.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the trouble with numbers, that too often we present numbers in ways that are difficult to understand. Most people in the UK and the US don't even know how many zeros there are in a billion. They've no idea what a number means once it's bigger than the value of their house. So one of the tricks that we tend to try to play with numbers is to bring those numbers down to size, to say what they mean per person. So when we hear about the financial stimulus package and we talk about $800 billion or $900 billion, that doesn't mean anything to anybody. A better way of putting it is to say that $800 billion is the same as $2,666 for every person in the US. And that's something that all of the people who live in the US can understand. They know what $2,500 is. It's quite a lot more than most of them spend on Christmas presents.
I was just going to say, I'm asking Todd to get out his checkbook now. Could you just write that check for your part?
Yeah, my $2,300 or my $800 billion.
either would be fine. But making the numbers fit to an individual person means that people have got some chance of making sense of them. We know that bailout package is going to be spent over 2 years, so it's the equivalent of about $1,300 a year for everybody in the US over the next 2 years. Do people think that's a good deal or not? Well, if it turns out to work, if it turns out to keep more people in jobs than would otherwise have been in jobs, if it stops the economy from slowing down, maybe that doesn't sound like quite a horrifyingly large number.
Well, Andrew, I want to ask you about job creation versus job preservation in this stimulus debate, because one thing that the administration has been saying is that the president's stimulus plan will create or preserve 2 to 3 million jobs or 3.5 million jobs. Well, this create number I understand, but preserve, that means jobs will not be lost that would have been lost. But there's no way to ever prove whether he's right, because the jobs were never lost and you don't know if they had done nothing, if that would have happened. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And one of the toughest things with all these kinds of numbers is knowing what would have happened if you hadn't done this. So one way of thinking about whether that's a plausible claim is to say, OK, so the stimulus plan is going to be about $400 billion a year extra that wouldn't otherwise have been spent. Is that a big sum or a small sum? Well, total US income for the whole economy is about $14 trillion a year. So the $400 billion is about 3% extra, 3% of money in the economy that wouldn't otherwise have been there. How many people are there in work in the US economy? Well, my guess is there are about 100 million people in work at any one time, maybe more than that. 3% of that is 3 million. So I think that the Obama administration figures sound roughly plausible.
But we'll never ever know.
We'll have no idea. Yeah. It could be that as a result of this stimulus package, people are persuaded that there's really a disaster in the economy. That's why the government administration is seeking to do this bold thing. And that will make them so terrified that they spend much less than they otherwise would have done. And there's no aggregate effect of the stimulus. If the stimulus had not been introduced, people would have thought there wasn't such a big problem and they would have felt more bold and more likely to spend anyway. Or it could be that because of the stimulus, people feel confident that there's a government really in control, and so they trust it and go out and spend even more, and the effect of the stimulus is bigger than the administration is claiming. None of us will ever know.
Andrew, we're going to leave it there. We've enjoyed having you. Hope you can come back. Andrew Dilnot is the co-author of The Numbers Game. Remember, everyone, numbers are beautiful. So is the news. We've got Mark Garrison here.
Thank you, Catherine. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama is heading out of Washington for the next couple of days. He wants to drum up support for his economic stimulus plan. He'll hold two town hall meetings today in Elkhart, Indiana, tomorrow in Fort Myers, Florida. Both towns have been hit hard in the economic downturn. Elkhart is known for making recreational vehicles. Its unemployment rate tops 15%. That's about double the national rate. The Fort Myers unemployment rate has spiked because of a drop in tourism and increased home closures. He'll also hold the president, Obama that is, will hold his first primetime news conference as president tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. On Capitol Hill, the president's stimulus plan appears to have just enough support in the Senate, where a key procedural hurdle is expected to be cleared later today. A full vote could come as early as tomorrow. After it passes, it still has to be tweaked. The House and Senate bills are different right now, and the president can't sign the stimulus into law until those bills match up. Palestinian officials say an Israeli attack killed a Palestinian fighter today in the northern Gaza Strip. Israel denies it was operating at the time of his death, and of course, Israeli elections come tomorrow. That's the news. Catherine Todd.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. I'm joined today by Todd Zwillick. As we all know, Congress is debating the stimulus plan, but we'd like to know what you really need.
There was a time in the 30s we moved from a six-day work week to a five-day work week. It's time for us to move into a four-day work week that would enable other people to get jobs And the people on the jobs would perform better. They would not suffer from burnout.
Hear, the four-day work week. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
Well, speaking of the stimulus, Catherine, they're calling part of the stimulus the modern-day equivalent of the electrical grid or the interstate highway system. There's $7 billion of the stimulus plan that's making its way right now, and it's devoted to bringing high-speed internet access to underserved parts of the country. Sounds like a pretty good idea to me. But technology experts worry that the multi-billion dollar plan would suffer if we don't take more time to look at exactly what we're getting for the money. One of those experts is Takeaway technology contributor Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a professor at the University of Virginia and is on the phone with us right now. Siva, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Todd.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine.
Well, Siva, extending high-speed internet access to rural areas sounds on its face, as I said, like a great idea. What's the problem? Why hesitate?
Well, the number one problem is we don't actually know how much of America can't be reached by high-speed internet as of today. The FCC has not really been interested for more than a decade in collecting accurate information on the penetration of broadband. So while the sort of the low-end estimate is that 6 million households, almost 5% of U.S. households, are beyond the reach of, for instance, cable modems, there's reason to believe it's much higher than that. The way the FCC has been counting is if one person in a county can get it, they color that county taken care of. And so we don't actually know the scope of the problem. The other thing is that to really do the job to get high-speed internet at the sort of rate that people in Japan and Denmark enjoy, Finland enjoy, we are going to have to spend much more than either the House or the Senate has put into their bill. And the House and the Senate are pretty close in their numbers right now, but you know we are talking about $7 billion in each of those bills, but it's going to take about $44 billion to really do the job. Now, so the question is this the best time and the best way to do this? If we don't actually know how many households need to be reached, we haven't agreed on the technological standards to reach them, and we're facing perhaps massive layoffs of cops and school teachers in the next 6 months if state and local governments don't get an infusion of federal cash. We might want to step back and say, is this one of the top 10 priorities of economic stimulus? Now, sure, people will be employed putting cable into the ground, but the down the road benefits of this are uncountable, but perhaps revolutionary.
Well, in fact, won't they help sort of get rid of the digital divide? And isn't that something we actually really need?
Well, yeah, we don't actually know what the number is, like what the fraction is, right, in this digital divide.
But you got to start somewhere, right?
Well, nobody really knows, unfortunately, yeah. Largely because one of the things that the government has done very well over the past 15 years or so is fund the installation of internet access in public libraries and schools through a number of different programs, especially the E-Rate program that's managed to subsidize access for a lot of people, and that's been terribly helpful. But of course, a lot of these schools and libraries in rural areas don't have broadband either. We're talking about using essentially dial-up speed to get in. So there's a lot of difference once you drop out of a major metropolitan area, largely because we've depended on private sector investment to get it done. And as we, as we've seen, if a company is looking at maintaining a good balance sheet, serving sparsely populated areas with utilities is not necessarily a good move on their part. So you really need either government incentives or regulation to get it done. But the real challenge here is not so much closing some fraction called the digital divide, but making sure that no matter where you grow up in America, you have equal access to information about the world and the ability to engage in commerce. And increasingly, as business activity relies on keeping your data on another platform or another server millions of miles away or thousands of miles away. It's really important for people who want to start up their own businesses or improve the cost of their own businesses to be able to have dependable data service at their homes.
Siva, we keep hearing about how this is a president and a presidential administration that is so tech-savvy. I mean, they couldn't pry the BlackBerry from his hands. Does that give you any more confidence that something good's going to happen here in terms of broadband and this presidential administration?
Oh, it does. It does. You know, regardless of the number that's in either bill, the fact is the FCC is going to actually work for us rather than working for the telecoms. At least that's all the initial indications we've had. And that alone, you know, tech savviness isn't really the challenge, but it is a matter of understanding who you work for and understanding that we should have in this country a comprehensive information policy, a comprehensive communication policy that doesn't just sort of play to the incumbents. It doesn't do favors for, you know, what we used to call cable companies and phone companies and are now, you know, basically unified telecoms, but instead makes, you know, pays attention to whether citizens are getting what they need, getting what they deserve, and getting what they want for a decent price.
All right, Siva, well, thanks for joining us. I just want to point out that Lyndon Johnson made his career bringing electricity to rural Texas, so maybe somebody's making their career bringing broadband to rural America. Siva?
Well, he also made his fortune by making sure that he controlled the FCC and that fed money into his radio empire.
That's right. Touche. Siva, thanks for joining us. Our guest, Siva Vaidyanathan, is a professor at the University of Virginia. And in New York, Mark Garrison is here with headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour, the Senate's version of an economic stimulus plan is expected to clear a key procedural hurdle today, but it's set to pass by the thinnest margin. Only three Republicans have said they'll support the deal. If they follow through, the package would pass in the Senate with 61 votes. It needs 60 to break through a filibuster. President Obama's special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, kicks off a visit to Pakistan today. He's giving a stark assessment of the task confronting the U.S. in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He says America is in for a long, difficult fight and at the moment working with inadequate resources. A new opinion poll of Afghans says only 40% believe their country is headed in the right direction. Our partners at the BBC helped put the poll together. The results say people in Afghanistan have significantly less confidence in their government and international forces there than they did a year ago. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is up for re-election in August. The Sri Lankan army says a female suicide bomber has killed 28 people at a refugee camp in northeastern Sri Lanka. Most are army personnel. The camp is in an area that was held by Tamil Tiger rebels until Sri Lankan government forces recently captured it. A new study in the journal Cancer says pregnant women who develop breast cancer don't have a greater risk of death or recurrence of cancer than non-pregnant young women. Some smaller earlier studies suggested maternity could make things worse. And that's the news. Todd and Catherine.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, as the president pushes on Congress to finalize that stimulus bill, including federal dollars for infrastructure all across the country, there are hundreds of billions. That's true. There are also hundreds of buildings commissioned by another president in another era of economic turmoil that are being torn down as we speak. These are buildings commissioned by the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, and FDR, and they're now being demolished. Tracy Rozon is a freelance reporter for the New York Times, and she has a front page story in today's Times that looks at a group that started a national movement to save the buildings built on the hard work and the backbone of the New Deal. Tracy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, but why are so many people trying to knock down these Art Deco buildings?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that it's twofold. First of all, the buildings, often they are 75 years old or so, are in a bit of rundown shape. You know, maybe the maintenance hasn't always been done on them. And secondly, to some people, they appear outmoded, sort of old-fashioned.
Right. Well, a lot of times when you talk about economic stimulus and economic progress, it's about just that. Forget about nostalgia. Let's have progress, right?
Right. Well, that's in fact, one of the buildings is in Ocala, Florida. It's a huge Art Deco-influenced auditorium. And during the public hearings on whether to demolish it, one of the town officials cut off a preservationist and said, look, we don't care what prom you went to there. We don't care that Buddy Holly played there or all this nostalgia. We just want to make the city grow, and this is one of the ways that we can do it.
Okay, so people are starting a movement to save these buildings. What's the attraction? Why are so many people trying to preserve Depression-era buildings? The Depression was depressing.
Well, yes, but the buildings weren't.
Right.
Buildings often contained incredible murals. There was an Indian school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that was full of murals. The cafeteria, all around the cafeteria, were these Native American themes. And it didn't seem to matter. That was bulldozed last July. So I think that the buildings themselves can be quite grand, and they can be on very valuable real estate.
There it is. You just put your thumb on it.
That developers are eyeing.
Right. Well, Depression-era buildings, that Art Deco, if people can't picture it in their minds, it has that kind of Gotham-y kind of, when people see Gotham in movies, Art Deco is the really grand kind of big lines, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was comparing, there's the Charity Hospital in New Orleans, which does have some flood damage in the basement, but that building is so huge, and it looks like something out of a Superman movie.
Right. All right. Well, Tracy, good luck. I'm not sure how many of these buildings are going to be torn down, but keep us informed how many they managed to keep.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Well, they're supposedly, it's increasing.
It's increasing, the ones that they're keeping. All right, well, we'll keep our eye on it. Tracy Razan is a reporter with the New York Times, and she's covering the threat
to Art Deco. The Depression was depressing? You and I are going to have a little chat about architecture.
I mean the Depression itself, not the architecture.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
I'm an Art Deco fan.
You'd never know.
You know, it's Gotham-y. Have you ever heard a better description of Art Deco than Gotham-y?
We'll chat.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford. John and Adora are away today, and I'm joined by Todd Zwillick, and we are both turning our attention now to Mark Garrison, who joins us from the newsroom with the latest.
Thank you, Catherine. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, Japanese car maker Nissan announced today that it will cut 20,000 jobs worldwide. That is a full 8.5% of its workforce. It has yet to say which plants will be hardest hit. The company is forecasting a net loss of nearly $3 billion this year. President Obama will be in Elkhart, Indiana today. He's working to round up support for his economic stimulus plan. The small city has an unemployment rate of more than 15%. That's about double the national rate. The president's stimulus plan could pass in the Senate as early as tomorrow, but then lawmakers have to fix the vast differences between that version and the one passed earlier by the House. A car bomb went off this morning on the outskirts of Madrid. Police say it damaged buildings but didn't hurt anyone. No group has claimed responsibility for the bombing yet, but a call warning of the attack reportedly came from an ETA representative, that is the Basque separatist group. Identity theft is on the rise. That's according to a new study. The number of cases jumped by more than 20% this year to nearly 10 million, but the study also finds that victims are quicker to strike back and limit how much money is stolen. And Egyptian archaeologists have found 30 mummies inside a 4,600-year-old tomb in Saqqara, and that's been going on for 150 years, and Todd's been there.
I've been to Saqqara. Very cool. Mummies. Oh, it's anything more fascinating than that.
That's what I got.
Okay. Our partners at the BBC have published a new national opinion poll based on their original reporting in Afghanistan. The new poll finds that Afghans are still resolutely opposed to the return of the Taliban, but increasingly disillusioned and uncertain about what the future might hold for their country. To learn more, we spoke with BBC correspondent Ian Pannell earlier this morning. And when we spoke, I asked Ian, what are we supposed to take away from the poll's findings?
Well, I think the broad picture here is that increasing numbers of people think that the country is going in the wrong direction. If you look at, so people were asked the basic question, which they're often asked in opinion polls in the States and elsewhere, is the country going the right direction or the wrong direction? Only 40% now say they think the country is going in the right direction, and that is down from 77% just 3 years ago. The primary problems are things like the economy and security, living conditions, violence, crime, all those kinds of issues which people hear about on media reports of what's going on in Afghanistan. But I think it paints a fairly gloomy picture that people are becoming increasingly pessimistic about the government, about the international presence in Afghanistan, and what the future is likely to hold.
And in fact, getting to the international presence, a little less than half said they had a positive view of the United States. And then a third said the United States is doing a good job. So what are we? How are we losing that difference there?
Yes, I mean, 32% said they thought the United States was doing a good or an excellent job. That's down from 68% in 2005. That's a pretty sharp fall. And there are a number of reasons for this. I think people expected to see greater benefits in a much shorter period of time. Now, people will say it's only a relatively short period of time in the history of the country. But, of course, people need to feel those benefits. I think the fact that economically, people are suffering. People do not have much money in their pockets. Afghanistan remains one of the poorest countries in the world. Parents quite often struggle to feed their children. And then you factor in the security issue that people feel that they are less safe. Issues like freedom of movement. Again, the figures show a decline in how free people feel to move around safely. Those are big issues in people's lives. If people do not feel secure, if they're worried about feeding their families, then they're going to start to blame those people who are responsible. So in some senses, the United States is an inevitable loser on that front because, of course, it has the biggest presence. It gives the largest amount of aid, has the largest presence of foreign forces here. But that's also reflected in the opinion of the government and the President Hamid Karzai as well. Ratings for both of those are also down.
Well, Ian, this is Todd Zwillick. I want to ask you, are there big differences in our perceptions of the problems in Afghanistan versus the Afghan people's perceptions? You know, when we see the problems in Afghanistan, we think of the Taliban and narco trafficking, poppies, that it's what we call a narco state. Do people there see drug trafficking and the Taliban as the root of their biggest problems the way we see it?
I think there are a number of differences. Of course, people have many more immediate issues, like the issue, for example, we travel to Mazar-i-Sharif, a beautiful city in the north of the country. Now, there people's concerns are economic. There isn't a security problem there. There's no presence of the Taliban. There are foreign forces, but you don't really see them. But if you go down to the local market and talk to people there, people are struggling to buy some pretty basic things. I watched one man ladle out huge amounts of mashed potato into a bag, and there were a few sort of pennies were handed over in exchange for it. I mean, people are buying small amounts of food, what they can afford at the time. But we also visited the local bus station there, and every day hundreds of people are getting on buses, heading for the south to Kabul, or heading to neighboring Pakistan or Iran. Imagine heading to those two countries in search of better economic opportunities. So those are things that I think we don't see very often on the news. But if you go to the south and the east of the country, it is the issue, yes, of the Taliban, but also the presence of foreign forces. Civilian casualties is a growing issue. Again, the results in the survey show people are overwhelmingly against the use of air power that might lead to civilian casualties. 77% say that is unacceptable. Well, in terms of the actual drug overlords that you talk about, well, of course, they are there, but it's not something that people see on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis. And if you talk to farmers who are involved in the poppy trade, Most of them are poor. They don't get lots of money from the poppy trade. They grow poppies because there's nothing else that they can grow that will get to market. Interestingly, when we were down there, they were waiting for wheat seed. And as you know, there's been global commodity prices rose dramatically, and the price of wheat was very high, and there was a shortage. And so the farmers there were looking for wheat seed to grow because they know that they could get more money for that. It's not because they're wedded to the drug scene. It's because many times that is their only option. That doesn't mean that there aren't other people profiting from it.
Quickly, what did the poll tell us about how people view corruption there? Certainly a big issue as far as the Obama administration is looking at their new relations with Afghanistan.
Yes, again, I think corruption is a big issue for people. And again, you see it on a daily basis. This market we were in Mazar-e-Sharif, we spoke to one man. His job was he had a wheelbarrow and he carted things around the muddy streets of Mazar-e-Sharif. And he was saying that he earned about $4 a day, but he had to give $1 of that to the local police. Whether or not he'd managed to earn $4 a day, a quarter of his income had to go to the police as a bribe. And we went round the corner and we were filming and we saw a police van driving along from shop to shop, collecting either goods or money from those outlets. So corruption is a problem at all levels. It's a problem on a basic street level. It's a problem at government level. But many people will say, well, hang around. You know, who was it that the United States got into bed with when it decided to overthrow the Taliban? Who were those people? What was their background? And many people will say, those are the people who actually were involved in corruption in the first place and should never have been brought to power, should never have been allied with the United States and Great Britain and other countries during the overthrow of the Taliban. So corruption is a huge issue, but the picture is never as simple as it looks.
All right. And so very quickly, since we have to wrap up, how does that complicate the Obama administration trying to come in with a new start?
I think it does make life much harder for them. It makes life much harder for the American troops, the extra American troops who are coming here. It makes their chances of success much more difficult. But they absolutely have to engage in the country. There are really no other options. And when they say there would be civil war if we weren't there, I have to say that's probably true.
And that's BBC correspondent Ian Pannell reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan, in an interview conducted earlier this morning.
And here we're talking about the economic stimulus plan. As Congress debates that bill, what do you really need? We want to know what you think about the stimulus plan money and how it should be spent. What kind of stimulus do you need in your city or town, in your personal life?
Consumers are confident when they have money. Government should put the money back in the hands of consumers, and then they'll spend. And that invigorates the economy, not spending by government.
I don't want the tax rebate. I'm going to get $500 back that I'm going to have to repay later at interest. But by the way, I can also help to pay back at interest the $10,000 that some multimillionaire gets. I think the money should go mostly into capital improvements.
Tell us what you really need or don't need from the economic stimulus package.
There's a consensus among scientists that $165 billion would actually set up the national grid so that we could use solar and wind energy. Otherwise, they are just pipe dreams because there doesn't exist the grid to deliver it from the source to the user.
Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
The point of the parties really are, I win, you lose. You win, I lose. So trying to sort of overcome this and all hold hands and jump together is very difficult.
Sounds grim. That's Time Magazine's J. Newton Small talking about the effort to get bipartisan compromise on the stimulus bill. As we're figuring out the details of the bill, there's only so much we can figure out as reporters from here. So we're enlisting you as our reporters to help us dig up more on individual projects happening around the country. Tell us what you want to know about how the stimulus is going in your area. Take part in our Project Shovel Ready at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
How do they put out financial flames in the nation's capital?
The building is on fire. And what we typically do in Washington is argue what color of fire truck do we send to the scene. They do not want us arguing about the color of the fire truck.
It's a five-alarm financial crisis, and the trucks are on their way. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 9th. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined by Catherine Lamfer. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away today. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Todd. In this hour, we go over the economic agenda for the week, look at the stimulus packages in other countries, and we vet the vetting process for the Obama administration. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
President Obama said he was excited to leave the road behind when he campaigned for president at the end of November, but today he's answering the call once again. He'll hold town meetings in Elkhart, Indiana today, looking for support for his economic stimulus plan. Later on, he'll appeal to a larger audience in the first primetime news conference of his administration. The president has already spent plenty of time sweet-talking lawmakers, but many Republicans still don't support the plan. That includes Republican Senator John Ensign of Nevada. He said yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press that Congress can't afford to get the plan wrong.
You need to get it right. You don't want to spend these precious taxpayer dollars in the wrong way.
Now, despite opposition, the bill is expected to pass in the Senate tomorrow. Three Republicans say they'll vote for it. Lawmakers have to then reconcile the major differences between it and the version passed earlier by the House.
Australian police are treating towns that were destroyed by fire over the weekend as crime scenes. They believe the 400 fires that tore through the country were deliberately set. Police are launching a high-level investigation. The fires have left Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd shaken.
What do you say? What do you say about anyone like that? What do you say? Don't know. Just, there's no words to describe it, other than it's mass murder.
More than 130 people have died so far. The government expects that figure to rise as the search through the wreckage continues. Robert Plant and Alison Krauss were the big winners at the Grammys last night. They won five in all, including Album of the Year for Raising Sand.
The Dow opens at 82.81 today. The S&P opens at 869. Both indicators jumped nearly 3% on Friday.
Congress is debating the stimulus plan, but what is it that you really need? How should the stimulus plan money be spent? Does your town need a new hospital, a new industry? Does your family need health insurance? We've been hearing from a number of you this morning, and we'd like to hear more. What do you want in your stimulus package?
I want an intern. It doesn't pay, but they'll have long-term job prospects.
Yeah, I don't think that's what they had in mind, Todd. All right. Go ahead. Tell us what you think. It's 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Now, you know, Todd, the United States is far from the only nation to develop a plan to get its economy back on track. At least 33 other countries have done the same. And this morning, we're going to look at how places like China or the European Union are doing to see how they're handling the challenge. Maybe there's some ideas we can steal. What advice do they have for us? We're joined by Justin Fox. He is a business and economics columnist for Time Magazine. He also does their Curious Capitalist blog. Hey, Justin, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
All right. If we're going to be curious about what other countries are doing, maybe we should start with China. They're the big guns, right?
Well, and they're the one other country on Earth that's really going whole hog to the extent that the U.S. is. at least in terms of the numbers they've put out.
What does whole hog mean in terms of China? And I now I'm hungry. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know
Mushu,
if that was the right
whole hog.
Terminology
yeah, okay.
there. But the issue is just that, I mean, the way to look at most of these stimulus packages is as a percentage of gross domestic product, as a percentage of the size of the economy. And everybody, all these different governments throw these numbers out there, and you don't know exactly what's new and what's not and what's this year and what's next year. But basically, China is the one other country where the package seems to be up there in the 5 or 6 or 7% of GDP
I think it was
range.
Something around 6%,
yeah.
right? All right. And they were including also a big push to get into rural areas. I remember the one thing that stuck with me, something like 13%. Some sort of, I don't want to say tax credit, but they
want
to get
rural
spending.
Families to buy washing machines, I think, and other appliances. That seemed to be one of the big things. And one of the interesting things with China is in the U.S. we're talking about doing this infrastructure spending. Basically, China has been spending hundreds of billions of dollars on new infrastructure every year anyway. And so when they announced we're going to do some more infrastructure spending, everybody kind of yawned. So it's these other plans in China, these tax breaks, these incentives to go buy
a washing machine.
Yeah, or, I mean, maybe they're talking more like blenders. I don't know, because you know, rural Chinese people in general aren't very wealthy.
So. But with such an export dependent economy, China's hurting because we're hurting because
right.
we're not buying their exports. Is there so much they can really do domestically because they don't have a lot of domestic demand, or do they?
Well, that's the whole idea of this: is to create some more domestic demand to create somebody else to buy all that stuff they're making besides us. And I think long-term China would like to switch to that. There are these countries like Japan and Germany that just always run surpluses, always export more than they bring in. But it sort of feels like the Chinese government over time, but you know, they want to do it on their own time frame, would like to switch to a place where they buy about as much as they sell.
Of course, it seems like the big debate in this country is how much do we want to do something that has a short-term impact
right.
to help goose the economy versus the long-term investment that we actually need. Are we seeing that same debate in all 33 other countries?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess in most of the countries, there's also much more, even more of a debate than there is in the U.S. about should we be doing this at all? Keynesian economics is just not as fashionable outside the English-speaking world as within. And also, there are a lot of emerging market countries. China's different because it just has these huge cash reserves built up over years of exporting more than they imported. But a lot of emerging market countries can't do what we're doing in the U.S. and borrow trillions of dollars on the global markets.
I was just going to say, so what sort of bind does that leave developing countries in?
That some of them, even though, I mean, basically what you hear from a lot of people from developing countries, oh, finally, a financial crisis that nobody can blame on us. But a lot of developing countries may end up being harder hit than the U.S. simply because they don't have the sort of fiscal leeway that we do.
Let's talk about some of the ideas we can steal. I mean, innovative measures in other countries.
Well, I mean, one of my favorites, because Alan Blinder, economics professor at Princeton and former vice chairman of the Fed, has been pushing this for about 6 or 7 months. And I guess it exists on the state level. But it's the idea of you create some sort of cash bonus to give to people who turn in their old junky polluting cars. And so the idea is you have this great environmental effect. You're getting old junky cars off the streets and you're giving people, I don't know, $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 that they would maybe use to go buy a new car or a newer car. And Germany actually has that. And it's kind of perverse because there aren't very many junky old cars on German streets. So I don't know how much impact, but it's very popular there apparently. That's one that I just wish I don't understand why Congress doesn't bite on that for the U.S. because we have much greater potential of really crummy old cars.
Lots of crummy old cars. They have fabulous cars in Germany. Well, Justin, is there any coordination going on here? You said that Congress isn't biting on these great ideas from Europe, but on 33 economic stimulus plans, are there 33 cats to be herded, or is there any coordination going on between economies?
Well, just the fact that every developed economy is either doing something or at least claiming to be doing something, I think a lot of people see that as this encouraging contrast to the 1930s when people could not get their act together. Everybody was always working at cross purposes. And basically the idea is if everybody's stimulating all at once, then you don't have a sudden run on the dollar or some other currency of a country that's stimulating. So I think the feeling and just generally you get more stimulus out there because all these different countries are doing it. So I wouldn't say it's super well coordinated, but I do think there's this general agreement that, oh, we all need to do something here.
Okay, and what about deficit? Because the U.S. has huge deficits, no doubt about it. China's in surplus, some economies in surplus, others in deficits like us. With all of this stimulus spending going on, is the world spending itself into greater deficit right now, or are they, or this deficits and the surpluses balancing out?
No, they don't. I mean, there's going to be a bunch. Well, what there is, there's going to be a bunch of government debt that wasn't there before. But the flip side of that is on the private level, consumers in the U.S. and businesses in the U.S. to a large extent are cutting back their borrowing really dramatically. And that's the whole argument for this stimulus, is that private borrowers aren't borrowing or can't borrow, so let the governments do it for 6 months or a year or 2 years or whatever. I mean, they can't do that forever, but that's the reasoning.
I want to go back to what the differences are between the discussion that's happening in this country and the discussion that's happening around the world outside this country.
Well, I mean, obviously, outside the – in terms of causes, everybody outside the country, you know, knows that the cause is the United States. so that's real simple for everybody to blame us. Within the U.S., we're still having all these discussions about, you know, was it Fannie Mae or was it bad regulation or was it
– What does that conversation look like to people outside this country?
Just like normal internal – blah, blah, blah.
Gas bagging.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think all countries have this internally. My sense is that the people looking at the U.S. from outside generally just want us to, you know, figure out something that gets our economy going again, and then they can all hammer on us later.
And getting back on Todd's question about coordination, the G20 is going to meet in April, I believe?
Correct.
All right. And will that serve as sort of a coordinating effort with all of these different stimulus plans?
Yeah, to some extent. I imagine that most of the discussion will be about sort of moving on to the next stage of a new global regime of banking regulation to some extent.
Ooh, and,
new world order. Exactly.
They don't usually like that discussion in Congress, do they?
No, and it'll be really interesting to see once Congress notices that it's going on in the rest of the world what the reaction is going to be. I mean, one of the things that a lot of the finance ministers from around the world want to do is make the IMF a lot bigger and more powerful than it is now.
Todd, I can't see that flying in Washington.
Well, I'll tell you what, it wouldn't have flied 10 years ago, that's for sure. But with a gigantic Democratic majority, I think the dynamic's a little bit different.
Well, and just the dynamic of the people who are going to be tiding us over through all this deficit spending for the rest of the next couple of years are mostly from the rest of the world, and I think to some extent we have to listen to them.
I can't help but wonder, with the 33 countries, all with the different stimulus packages, the new administration here, are we going to see a change in some of the international relations with our financial leaders and financial leaders in Europe? I mean, is there any some sort of change that's going to happen because everyone's in this mess?
It feels like the time of basically the U.S. calling all the shots on how global financial structure is put together. It feels like that's going to be over. But I guess there's so many people who have spent so much time over the past 30 years predicting the end of U.S. dominance in one thing or the other that I'm always a little dubious of saying. But it feels like there's this new world coming where places like China and India will have a lot more say, and the U.S. will have a bit less.
Justin, always good to talk to you. Justin Fox is a business and economics columnist for Time Magazine. Todd?
Well, Congress is debating that stimulus plan, but what do you really need? We want to know where you think the stimulus money should be spent. So tell us, does your town need a new road? Does your family need help with your mortgage? What kind of stimulus do you want to see in your city or town? Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know what you think.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away, and Todd Zwillick is here with me today. Good to have him here. Congress is debating the stimulus plan, but what do you really need? We want to know where you think the stimulus plan money should be spent. Here's what Ricardo had to say on our website. How about $10,000 for any family that has at least two kids under the age of four in daycare and are both employed full-time? I think he means the parents there. Not a tax break, but an actual check. It would make the difference in several things: saving for college, eating out, buying new clothes, taking a vacation, saving to buy for a new car. I mean, he goes on this list. Obviously, Todd, things that he thinks can help goose up the economy. He goes on to say, many families are just getting by who make a decent salary, but daycare costs eat up most of the quote-unquote disposable income for several years when the kids are young. All right, that is Ricardo's idea, but what is yours? New roads for your town? More help with your mortgage? What kind of stimulus do you want to see? Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or go to The Takeaway, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
Well, once again, it's time to open up the agenda for the week. It's Monday, and every Monday on The Takeaway, we take a look ahead at what we can expect for the upcoming 7 days. This week, we're talking to Stephanie Mehta, an assistant managing editor at Fortune. She's here to talk to us about the Senate and the stimulus, about the Treasury and the TARP, not to mention President Barack Obama back on the campaign trail. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, how are you, Todd?
I'm well, thank you. Well, the president is off to Indiana today to sell the stimulus, and then he has a news conference tonight to sell it some more. But he has the votes to pass it in the Senate. Why go through all this?
Well, I think it's very much about winning the public relations war and taking back some of the momentum from the Republicans, who've been very effective in saying that there's a lot of pork in the stimulus bill and that there needs to be more direct spending, more direct stimulus, money in the pockets of people like Ricardo, as opposed to government spending programs that ultimately could also stimulate the economy but may not have that direct impact on the individual taxpayer that a tax credit or a tax rebate might have. And so I think, first and foremost, President Obama is trying to take back some of that momentum, try to win back support for a stimulus package that includes a combination of the tax credits as well as the government spending to stimulate the economy. I think the other thing is that it's my opinion that this is not the end of stimulus legislation, mm-hmm. that we're probably going to see some follow-on legislation. You know, a lot of economists, including Paul Krugman of Princeton University and the New York Times, believe that the stimulus package that the Senate and House are likely to pass this week is not enough. And there's a very good argument to be made that, you know, there could be more spending. And so I suspect that one of the things that the president is going to have to do is set the stage for additional financial government support, whether it's stimulus package or TARP, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit later.
He also has to set the stage for TARP. Now, that announcement was originally going to come today. They decided they wanted the attention to be on the stimulus and let Tim Geithner lobby Capitol Hill today. So they'll put the TARP announcement tomorrow. What's likely to be in that plan, and does the president have some selling to do there?
I think there has to be a lot of selling to do there, and it's interesting because the spin is, we delayed this till Tuesday because we need Geithner to spend Monday selling stimulus. If you read between the lines in some of the reporting today, it becomes pretty apparent that all the details of the Tuesday announcement haven't yet been worked out. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were buying a little time. That said, you know, one of the very interesting components of this latest plan out of Treasury is that it's likely to include some sort of public-private partnership in terms of buying up these bad assets that all the banks have on their books. And that's we're talking about some very unprecedented, uncharted waters here. And so it's going to be very complicated to explain. It's going to be pretty complicated to sell. And I think that given all of the backlash around TARP 1, TARP 2 is certainly going to require some careful handling.
But didn't the reaction to TARP 1 sort of give us the public-private partnership in TARP 2? I mean, isn't there more of a push that we don't want to have a nationalized system?
Absolutely. But again, there are a lot of there's a lot of fine print that all of these the parties are going to have to explain. And I think that the opaqueness of TARP 1 has given way to a need for much more transparency in TARP 2.
What about housing? Because you say it's murky what's going to happen on Tuesday, but the Senate, Senator Chris Dodd, who's chairman of the Banking Committee, got an amendment passed in the stimulus that has nothing to do with the stimulus. The amendment in the stimulus says you got to spend at least $50 billion in the TARP on mortgage, on foreclosure mitigation. And he said, I'm not taking anyone's word for it. The Bush administration basically promised me one thing and did another, and I'm not going to take the risk that the Obama administration does that. He may be posturing a little bit, but is that housing amendment going to make any difference? Will that push the administration to do something on housing in the TARP?
Well, as I understand it, all of those details have not yet been worked out for that portion of TARP.
Sounds like he's trying to force them into it.
It does sound like he's trying to force them into it. And I also think, you know, again, coming back to my original idea that we're going to see a lot more legislation coming out, that the stimulus package and TARP 2 are by no means the end of the road. There is discussion of yet another set of proposals that the Obama administration is going to be unveiling later in the week that specifically have to do with housing. And so whether Senator Dodd's legislation around mortgage backs and helping the homeowner make it into this particular stimulus package, I suspect that, you know, the Obama administration and Congress understand fully that they're going to have to solve the housing problem. It really is a three-pronged issue. It's solving the financial crisis, it's putting people back to work, and it's dealing with housing. And all three are at crisis stage right now. And, you know, it's a massive undertaking to try to unravel all three.
And he stepped right on their toes, didn't he? It was interesting to see him do that. He's not taking anyone's word for it. Let me switch gears real quick and take you to one other issue I want to cover. These three Republicans who are helping to pass the stimulus, they're the moderates. Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, and Arlen Specter, who's from Pennsylvania. Now, we knew on November 4th, on election night, when we knew that there was 57 or 58 Democratic votes in the Senate, that these three people would be important. That was, to those of us who watch politics, that was obvious from the beginning. They're the ones you can quote peel off to vote with Democrats. Why did they choose this fight to take a stand and show their power? And what does it mean maybe for the TARP or for upcoming further stimulus packages?
Well, this is your area more than mine, Todd, but I suspect that Arlen Specter is looking at Pennsylvania and looking at the fact that the state went for Obama, looking at the fact that, you know, it is a Democratic state now, and he's probably thinking, if I want to protect my Senate seat, I need to start getting in line with the mainstream of my state. I think the other thing is that, you know, I think that this is an issue that does resonate with the average American. I think that the mainstream American is saying, you know, yeah, we need to get something passed. We need to get something passed quickly. We need to put people back to work. There's a huge psychological effect associated with getting people back to work and feeling like the economy is moving.
Stephanie Mehta, thank you so much. Stephanie Mehta, Assistant Managing Editor at Fortune.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. Femi Okeh is away, too, but we've got it covered. Mark Garrison's here with headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Coming up on 33 minutes after the hour, U.S. markets have just opened. The Dow's down around 25 points, just a little smidge. European markets have basically been flat. Tokyo's Nikkei index dropped more than 1% as automaker Nissan reported a huge loss and big layoffs. The economic stimulus bill is on investors' minds, of course. It's taking longer than expected. It's likely to pass tomorrow in the Senate, but then lawmakers must then reconcile that version of the bill with the different one that passed earlier in the House. Investors are also awaiting a speech by Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner Center on Tuesday. This will outline the Obama administration's plan to overhaul the government's $700 billion financial bailout package. Geithner had been scheduled to announce the plan today, but the speech was pushed back so Washington could focus on the stimulus bill. A person familiar with the talks says GM is discussing taking back some factories from its former parts division, Delphi. Delphi has been operating under Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection for more than 3 years. Like many suppliers, it's struggling with these shrinking U.S. auto markets. An arrest put a cloud over last night's Grammy Awards. Los Angeles police are investigating an incident involving R&B singer Chris Brown. A woman called 911, accused him of hurting her, and news of the incident broke just before the awards. Brown was arrested, canceled his appearance. His girlfriend is singer Rihanna. She was also due at the Grammys last night. Like Brown, she dropped out shortly before the show started.
All right, Mark. Thanks for that.
Put a damper on the night. Well, Catherine, I have a question. Tom Daschle, Bill Richardson, Tim Geithner, Nancy Killefer. What do all of these names have in common?
I'm afraid nothing good at the moment. Some sad news, right?
Well, that's exactly right. They were all named to big jobs in the Obama administration, and they all stumbled or fell because during the nomination process, they had vetting problems. So you have to wonder, does the Obama administration's vetting process have some cracks in it? Obviously it does, but where are they? You can add to the list, by the way, Labor Secretary nominee Hilda Solis. Her husband has some tax issues. Not her, but her husband. Well, Ken Gross is a vetting expert who worked for Bill Clinton in 1992. He's done plenty of vetting, and he's joining us to talk about whether the Obama administration is dropping the ball during the vetting process. Ken, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, aside from the obvious, which is taxes in most cases, do you see a pattern here? Is this a sign of some kind of systemic problem in the Obama vetting operation, or is there just uncertainty in the process inherent that you just have to deal with?
Well, I think people are probably scratching their heads over there because I've reviewed all the Obama vetting materials. I've represented people going into this administration. I've seen it from that perspective, and it is the most thorough vetting process that I've seen. It's been going on for months now, even before the election, with regard to some of his top people who we're talking about here. And, you know, I guess there's always room for error if someone isn't fully disclosing things during the process or there's a miscalculation of the impact. Some of this problem is the timing. You know, perhaps if one of these incidents had occurred early, it wouldn't have been a problem. But on the heels of the other one, it becomes a snowball effect.
And everybody on Capitol Hill says the only difference between Geithner and Daschle was that Geithner went first. And if Daschle had gone first, he would have gotten through and Geithner would have tanked.
I think that's probably correct. And the lady from the White House had a very small problem. And she would have, I think, sailed through if she had been first.
So is it just the case that it's sometimes hard, no matter how thorough your vetting, no matter how intrusive your forms or your questions are, that sometimes you just can't rely on people to be completely honest? Or is it a question of knowing about a problem and saying, well, we'll get by this, it won't be a big deal, and making a press or a political calculation that turns out to be incorrect?
That it could be either one. The Daschle one is probably the most curious because, according to the reports, he's known about some of these problems for months, particularly this car and driver and the tax issues related to it. And the number one issue when it comes to vetting is no surprises. You know, if you know about something, then you can make a calculation. Okay, this is something we're going to fight for because we wish it didn't happen, but we can fight for it because this person's really important. We're braced for it. But when something comes out of the woodwork after the name has been sent up, that is where the damage control is, very difficult. And someone at his level of political sophistication and exposure to Washington ways, it really is curious. And we never really did get the confirmation hearing to see exactly what the excuse was or why it developed the way it did.
Well, you're talking about the Finance Committee, and I have to ask a question that's bugging a lot of people on Capitol Hill. Tom Daschle was in the Senate for, I think, 20 years, and he was a member of the Finance Committee. So he knew better than anyone that every single nominee, no matter how small the job, how big the job, every single nominee in front of the Finance Committee gets a full tax review as a matter of routine. He must have known that. So how the heck did this happen?
Well, I don't know. I think he probably would have been confirmed.
Right.
It would have been at a cost because he did have so many friends on Capitol Hill, and he does bring a lot to the table, unfortunately, for that HHS job, you know, to lose him is not a good thing for the administration. But I think it was this inability to explain why this didn't come out may have been the ultimate reason why he pulled out. It just doesn't look good, and it's so hard to explain why something would come out after the fact. It's hard for me to believe that they knew about it and just, you know, hoped somehow it wouldn't emerge.
Well, this is Catherine Lanfer. I can't help but wonder, though, if part of it was that the ground shifted pretty quickly on the Obama administration in that when you have a populace that is so angry about money that is being handed out everywhere and not everyone, it seemed to me like the tax problems of some of the appointees got mixed up with general anger about the TARP money, about banks getting money handed to them. It almost seemed as if there was an entire ruling class out there that just wasn't paying attention to details that everyone else has to sweat.
Well, and also President Obama himself set a very high bar, which was a good thing that he brought in, an era of ethics, to have Geithner, who's going to oversee the tax department, have a tax problem, and that's a major body blow, and it just could not be withstood on the heels of it. And as you say, it was contrary to the mood of the nation as well.
Well, let me ask you real quick about Bill Richardson, because he was the nominee to be the Commerce Secretary, the first nominee, if people remember. And he stepped aside after, you know, pursuant to a pay-to-play investigation in his state. And it never went any further than that, what his role was. Was that something that the vetters knew about and then probably decided at a later date just was going to be too hard to defend quickly?
Yeah, the bettors certainly knew about the pay-to-play issues in Richardson. They may have not have known the level of his involvement, and they made a calculus there, which I think was a close call in his case, but they made a calculus not to push that one.
Ken, thanks for being with us. Ken Gross is a vetting expert and a partner at Skadden & Arps in Washington, D.C.
All right, we've been debating the stimulus plan. Let's hear what you have to say.
Hi, this is Earlene McKee. I live in South Carolina. What I would like for my stimulus package, I would not like to get any further in debt to foreign countries. We're way too much there already. They own us.
We'd like to hear from you. What should be in the stimulus plan? Call us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE. What shouldn't be there? mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to The Takeaway. John and Adore are away.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, no one knows whether New York Yankees Alex Rodriguez will ever overcome the blow to his reputation caused by revelations that he used steroids in 2003. But one thing is for certain. Had the Baseball Players Association not held on to voluntary test samples submitted by A-Rod and other players, none of this would have ever come to light. Well, Anthony Reber is a Newsday baseball writer. He's covering the story, and he's joining us from Tampa to talk about what exactly went wrong, at least from A-Rod's perspective. Anthony?
Good morning.
Hi. Take us quickly through what happened here. Players gave samples in 2003 just as part of a survey of drug use in the big leagues, right? But those samples were supposed to have been destroyed.
Yes. The agreement with the union in Major League Baseball was that they would do the tests. They were anonymous. There were no penalties if you failed. And the union had the right to destroy the test results. For some reason, that is only known to them and has not been explained, and I imagine will be, hopefully, in the next few days. They did not destroy those test results. The test results were then seized by the government, who found them in a Balco lab when they were trying to bring a case against Barry Bonds and others.
In San Francisco, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The government has had them since, I believe, 2004. And it's been the subject of a court case between the union and the government. The union doesn't want the names released. The government does, or at least wants to be able to. And then this one test result with Alex Rodriguez leaked out.
And we should mention that Rodriguez was playing for Texas at the time, correct?
Yes, that's true.
All right. Well, how much are players actually aware of the union's involvement in this? Is this going to change the players' relationship with the Players Association?
I would say that most players are not aware of it, even with all the headlines with A-Rod. Most players are pretty oblivious to these situations, and they might rely on their agents to be outraged for them. But I would imagine that it's less than three players per clubhouse that would even be aware of the situation in terms of what the union screwed up.
All right, well, Anthony, I want you to listen to a piece of sound we have from A-Rod back in December 2007 and what he said.
I've never felt overmatched on the baseball field. I've always been in a very strong, dominant position. And I felt that if I did my work, since I was a rookie back in Seattle, I didn't have a problem competing at any level.
Right. Well, whether the warrant was valid or not, or whether the samples ever should have been kept, Alex Rodriguez cheated, right? I mean, how does this affects his reputation? He's a cheater.
Well, Alex Rodriguez is reported to have failed a drug test.
Okay.
Whether he actually failed the test or not, he has the right to come out in the coming days and say, no, I didn't, it was a mistake. So we have to wait for that side of the story. But let's assume that the Sports Illustrated report was accurate, which I'm sure it was. It tarnishes his legacy to no end. I mean, Alex Rodriguez was a polarizing force anyway, hated by some, loved by some. But you were never indifferent to him, at least not in New York. Now, he's a pariah. It's damaging. It'll probably never get into the Hall of Fame unless somehow he can prove that this wasn't true.
You can't prove a negative. He'll never prove it's not true,
well,
right?
Well, that's the problem with these reports. And like, yeah. I said, I believe it's true because I know the quality of the journalism that's been practiced here. But let's say it isn't. There's nothing he can do short of Sports Illustrated coming out and saying, well, we were wrong.
All right. Anthony Reber is Newsday baseball writer. Talk to us about Alex Rodriguez and his alleged drug use as reported in Sports Illustrated. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. John and Adora are away today, joined today by Todd Zwillick. But we're going to turn now to Mark Garrison with the latest from the newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, the president's economic stimulus plan is expected to pass in a Senate vote tomorrow. Just three Republicans are expected to join Democrats in voting for the plan. Republicans like Nevada Senator John Ensign are criticizing the bill.
You need to get it right. You don't want to spend these precious taxpayer dollars in the wrong way.
As Senator Ensign on NBC's Meet the Press, if and when the stimulus package does pass the Senate, it's not over. Lawmakers then face the challenging task of merging it with the different version passed earlier by the House. The bills have to match before the president can sign them into law. Identity theft is on the rise. That's according to a new study. The number of cases jumped by more than 20% last year to nearly 10 million. The good news in there is that victims are now quicker to strike back and limit how much money is stolen. Most people are taken for less than $500. Just 11% of the thefts actually occurred online. Most came through stolen wallets and purses. Dozens are dead after a rebel suicide bomber blew herself up today. This was at a compound where Sri Lankan government forces were processing civilians fleeing the northern war zone. It's the first major suicide attack in Sri Lanka in weeks. This is spurring fears the Tamil Tiger rebels will turn to guerrilla warfare in their battle against the government. Comedian George Carlin was among those honored at the Grammys last night. He won a posthumous award for a recording of his final HBO comedy special. The award was accepted by his daughter, Kelly. She said she would take better care of it than her father did of his statuette before. She said he took it apart in a, quote, chemically induced altered state. So hopefully they've been a little bit better these days. But as far as people who can mangle their statues free to like that, also winning last night, Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, they got Record of the Year as well as Album of the Year, Record of being one song, Album of the Year, like that. Coldplay for Song of the Year and Weezer for Best Video. If you like internet memes, that's one you can check out. So.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Well, Congress is debating that stimulus plan, but what do you really need? We want to know where you think the stimulus money should be spent in your neighborhood.
James Motorano from Yorktown, New York. We need a new senior center. We don't have a senior center to speak of. We have a room or so, and we've been trying to build one for a long time, and this would be a perfect advantage to put people to work and also to provide something wonderful for our senior citizens.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Nadia Suleiman is the Californian woman who recently gave birth to octuplets after having in vitro fertilization treatment, and she has begun speaking out to the media about her experience.
I took a risk. It's a gamble. It always is. And a lot of couples, usually it's couples, do undergo this procedure, you know, and it's not as controversial because they're couples, so it's more acceptable to society.
That is Nadia Suleiman's takeaway on what happened. We're going to go now to Dr. Samantha Butts. She's an OBGYN at the University of Pennsylvania Health System and an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She says our health system actually helps to make multiple births more likely here. Well, welcome to the show, Dr. Butts.
Good morning.
Now, what is it? What is the setup in this country where a set of octuplets is going to be more likely than, say, in another country?
Well, I would just start by saying that this event is highly unusual in the scope of what happens in most clinical IVF practices. This is a significant outlier. But what I would say...
And I'm going to interrupt you there. When
sure.
you say it's unusual, you mean that she actually gave birth to eight children, not that eight embryos were implanted?
Well, that she had eight embryos that were implanted. And, you know, I think the details of the case are still fully coming to light. But, you know, we have guidelines that are generated by the American Society for Reproductive Medicine that help physicians who practice infertility and treat patients with in vitro fertilization offer safe options for IVF treatment for patients that are aimed to reduce the probability of pregnancies with triplets or higher, because we know that the safest outcomes occur when you have one baby at a time. In countries, like in many European countries, governments have a lot more control over regulating medical practices related to in vitro fertilization, primarily because they are covering the cost of all these services, so they can make the rules.
When you say that they're, but isn't it also that if someone else is picking up the tab, then couples are more likely to try several times with fewer numbers of embryos?
Well, I think if somebody's picking up the tab, certainly fewer numbers of embryos, as is happening in Europe, are going to be transferred back each time because, you know, there's certainly an interest on the government's part to reduce the probability of triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets, and higher order babies from occurring because of the risks that we know for moms and babies, both short-term and long-term.
You talked about how I want to get back to media coverage for a moment.
Absolutely.
How is it that the media coverage of octuplet births, for instance, or any kind of multiple birth, how does that get in the way of the guidelines that you are trying to convince people of?
Well, I think these guidelines have to be communicated to patients when you are taking care of them and seeing them in the office. I think where media coverage can make this conversation a little bit tougher is because I don't think it always presents a completely balanced picture of what happens to babies and families where, you know, a high-order multiple pregnancy, which again is triplets or higher, happens. A lot of times we don't see the really complicated cases where, you know, babies may die shortly after birth or a pregnancy may be lost completely. And I think the lack of balance is what gives people a skewed idea of what happens in these pregnancies in real life. And it sometimes makes it more difficult for us to counsel patients about the risks because they're seeing a very different picture in public media outlets.
Okay, Dr. Butts, sensationalistic media coverage is one thing, but But what is where's the responsibility for the physicians who are implanting 8 embryos in a mother? And I ask that based on the data, really, is there any indication that there's a health advantage or a benefit to doing this? Do you know, based on scientific studies, where the inflection point is? Do you do any better with 8 than you would have done with 3? Why are people doing this?
Well, I think there's a significant amount of responsibility that lies with the physician to adhere to guidelines and to educate their patients about, you know, why we're doing what we're doing and what the benefits are and the risks.
And let me just interject here as well. She also already had 6 children, and I know a number of people are looking at that and saying, doesn't the doctor at some point have a responsibility to say, how are you going to take care of 14 children?
Right. I think it becomes a little bit difficult to sort of treat that and negotiate that. I think where the primary responsibility of the physician lies is in trying to achieve a pregnancy with one baby at a time, as well as that can be achieved. At a certain point, when we're discussing putting back numbers of embryos with in vitro fertilization, putting back more embryos over a certain recommended number doesn't necessarily improve the chances of pregnancy at all. It just increases the chances of pregnancy with many children at a time, and we know that's very risky.
All right.
And it's not what we want.
Dr. Butts, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Samantha Butts. She is a doctor in OBGYN at the University of Pennsylvania Health System.
Well, we've been talking all day about the federal economic stimulus plan here on The Takeaway. How should the stimulus money be spent?
Hi, my name is Katie Roberts, and I live in Columbia, South Carolina, and we need some tax help. We are not foreclosing on our home. We do have a great deal of personal debt with medical debt and things like that. My husband owns his own business, and he has work for people to do. He cannot afford to hire them because our tax obligation is so high personally and professionally. It is becoming increasingly difficult to get ahead.
Hi, my name is Walter Magnuson. I'm calling from Savannah, Georgia. One of the best long-term ideas of a stimulus would be the proposal out there to show America that we can build high-speed, energy-efficient trains, and that would make jobs at every level, including, you know, just manual level labor up to engineering.
8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org are the numbers to call or the websites to visit to tell us what you need. And what else should you definitely know about the stimulus bill? It's not the end. Here's your takeaway.
We're going to see a lot more legislation coming out that the stimulus package and TARP 2 are by no means the end of the road.
That's Stephanie Maida from Fortune magazine. And as we talk about the stimulus bill, there's only so much we can find out as reporters here. So we're enlisting you as our reporters to help us dig up more on individual projects happening around the country. Tell us what you know about where the stimulus money is going in your area. Take part in our project. Go to the website shovelwatch.org to find out more.
I'm Catherine Lanford.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are away. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.